Hi, it's Eben Pagan. Today I'm talking to a gentleman named Scott Hallman. Scott and I met actually in the back of a limousine. We went to a networking party together, and we were both in the back of the same car on the ride home. It was this kind of group thing, and a really neat group of guys was riding back together. We started talking, and I realized that this was somebody that not only understood business and marketing, but who had actually built several companies on his own and really was just a superstar in every possible way. And he also has, was introduced to me with, great endorsement by a couple other people that were there in the back of that limo as well. I then learned that Scott had two different companies that were each individually and independently listed in the Inc. 500 fastest growing private companies in America, which is interesting. He did that twice. And he also told me the story about how he built a company from zero to $85 million, a company that he co-founded, and he did that in 21 months. So Scott's going to talk a little bit about business growth and rapid business growth. He specializes in applying principles of business growth to become more efficient, to make more profit, to implement and use metrics in your business so that you can get every drop you can out of it. So welcome, Scott.
Thank you. Enjoy it.
So will you just tell me how to build a company from zero to $85 million in 21 months? Because I think everybody wants to know that. And I think you raised, how much did you raise? 70-something million dollars?
$77 million on a business plan, on a multiple sheets of paper, but that was it. And it was exciting. You know, it was during the dot-com era, and we started at this in 98 and then really formed the company in 99. And it was an interesting challenge because we wanted to raise the money and we knew how we wanted to use it. But, we went to the venture capitalist and we went to the private equity bankers and we went to them with our idea, which was essentially saying that in the mid-market, companies back then that were 100 million to about 600 or 700 million were for the most part neglected by all the big five or the big four or the big three or the big six, whichever it is, depending on acquisitions, but all the big accounting firms and consulting firms. So what we did was we said, gosh, that middle market, that middle area is really neglected. And what ended up happening is the success rate of implementing systems like everything from ERP implementations to customer relationship management systems was very fragmented and very poor for these companies. So we said, gosh, you know what? Let's bolt together a whole bunch of expert companies with expert technologies, and let's create one vision of that customer, one integrated vision of that customer, so that we can integrate in our marketing automation, our Salesforce automation, our call center, and create one common view of that customer that we can arm our clients with. And that's what we set out to do, and the company was called One Inc., as a matter of fact. And so we said, what we're going to do first is we're going to go find the experts and that have each one of these expertises in technology, and we're gonna acquire them, and then we're gonna bolt them all together, and we're gonna organically grow the heck out of them. And that's what we did. So just to let you know, is we started off wanting to buy eight companies, and we started off with 6,800. So myself and my co-founder and a team of four of us spent 9 months combing through these, contacting companies, building the strategy, going and raising the money to the point where finally, here's the fun impasse, which was they said, okay, I'll tell you what, we're going to give you the money. And by the way, not give you a little bit of the money. We're going to give you all of the money and put it in an escrow account for you guys to use. There's only one catch. You have to bring me the first acquisition. So you run over there to the guys you want to acquire and you say, okay, we're ready to acquire you. You know, but we don't have any money yet. So I'll never forget the day that we bought the first company. And our goal was to build a $465 million company over 5 years. We acquired the company and the first company, we got our funding, and then we set out to strategically buy other technologies in order to make it all work together. And then we had a massive plan because you're integrating, various different personalities and geographically located folks into one vision and one company. But we were able to do that very successfully, and we grew like a rocket ship. And, you know, I think I'd shared the story with you that right before we were going public, we were 20 days from going out and going public for a value, post-close date value of $1.4 billion. And when the market took its turn in May of 2000, and we said, let's just sort of wait. And even though we didn't have a lot of internet companies, when the market, you know, took its dive, you know, we participated in that as well. So it was a wild toad ride, but we had, you know, multiple nights. I worked every night until 10 o'clock at night, including Fridays and Saturday nights for 3 years. So,
And that wasn't even one of your Inc. 500 fastest growing companies, was it?
No, it was not.
So you've been at this. you got a little success under your belt. So, you know, most of the people that are going to be listening to this, their aspiration is not to grow an $85 million company in 21 months, although they wouldn't be opposed to it. I just find it fascinating that with, you know, all of this experience that you have of the different areas, the different leverage points within business allowed you to take a good idea and then take the money and actually execute on it and create something that quickly. It's amazing.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting, Evan, because it's really been this school of learning in the trenches for me. You know, I was like a lot of the entrepreneurs, I'm sure, that are listening to this. I had no money. I had no experience. I had no mentor like you have now and no coaches like you have now. You know, I came up with an idea when I was in college and went to USC through the entrepreneur program there, and created this concept and took and ran with it fresh out of college, the first company that I built. And, you know, I borrowed $5,000 from my landlord back in the early 80s, by the way. It was the worst recession in the history other than the Depression, I guess. And, you know, had to take and run from there. And, you know, it was a challenging environment, but I didn't really know it. I was pretty passionate. So I faced the, you know, not knowing what I'm going to do about payroll on a Friday, but figuring out how to cover it by Monday when the checks actually, you know, went through, and trying to figure out, how do I grow this thing with no money, you know? And so I faced a lot of those real world issues that I'm sure a lot of listeners on the phone experience on an ongoing basis.
That's fantastic. So will you talk a little bit about, you know, what's the difference between, you know, a good business growth principle and just an idea for business? Like, what is it that makes the things that you do special?
Well, first of all, I use the word systematization a lot. And what I mean by that is, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs want to grow and build their businesses by the seat of their pants. And there was a day, I guess, where you could get away with that, but you can't get away with it today. Today, you've got guys like Walmart and Costco and even grocery stores that are have entered into the small business world in a big, big way. And they're sophisticated, and they got a lot of money behind them. So the key, as I always tell folks, is, you know, when you go to grow a business, number one, you obviously have to have a good plan and a good strategy, but then you have to be focused on optimizing profitability and reducing your risk from day one. Again, it's very different than before. And what that means is that you need to get clear on your marketplace. You need to create your marketing before you go spend a whole bunch of money on ads or marketing or the internet. You need to test it. You need to validate it. And then you need to put it in place with metrics. And this is what I call the boring way to riches. Because what happens is, if you don't have the metrics, you have no way of optimizing what you're doing. So a guy goes, yeah, I think it's working pretty well. We're getting a lot of leads. Or we're getting 100 leads a month. I said, yeah, what's your conversion rate? It's pretty good. Well, pretty good isn't good enough. You need to know that it's 63%. And that if you make these changes to optimize that system, you can get it up to 70%. And when you do that, your profitability goes from whatever, $50,000 a year to $100,000 a year. And you can then cement that system in place. So those are the keys that I focus on is, hey, let's get our arms around what we're trying to achieve. Let's set up our targets. Let's make sure we can measure those targets. And let's constantly optimize. Because, you know, everybody's too focused on trying to grow and get more customers when they can make so much more money on the customers that they already have.
All right. So, you know that you and I have a lot of kind of overlapping kind of thoughts about things. I mean, it seems like in any area, when you find people that are successful, they've discovered a lot of the same things, and you've got a lot of really cool stuff that obviously that I haven't discovered or that I haven't heard. This is a great little formula here. Maybe we could just rip into this. What is it that someone should do when they're in the planning and strategizing phase? Or should they even do that first?
Well, you know, it's interesting. If you're talking about before somebody started a business, the first thing that somebody should do is typically what happens is somebody wants to start a business and they have something they're interested in. And typically what happens is most businesses, 85% of businesses in America, according to Gerber, are started by technicians. That means I'm a plumber, I start my own plumbing business. I'm a copywriter, I'm going to go into copywriting business, and et cetera. So the first thing you need to do is to make sure that you understand your marketplace. And this is really critical. So for example, I wanted to start a optometry office right now, or an optician office where I'm going to glasses and contacts, et cetera. I need to really understand in my marketplace what the opportunities are there. You know, what's Costco doing? What's my local competition doing? How do I need to make sure I position myself to be unique in the marketplace? Because without that, I just say, oh, that's what I do, and I want to go ahead and start this. It's very, very difficult to succeed. You really have to be different now. And so the first step is to make sure that you're positioned properly in the first place, and you really understand that there's a market and a need for your unique talents and services that you plan on offering. This is absolutely key number one. Why waste your resources? Why spend all the time and energy in a crappy business? I do personal coaching of a select few clients, and I can't tell you how often somebody comes to me and they take a look at their business, and I go, you're in a bad business. This is just a bad business. You know, if you're in developing CDs right now and that's your focus, and you're not moving into the more, you know, the digital MP3 world, you know, and you don't make an adjustment, you're in trouble.
Mm. I agree with you that most people that are starting a business don't do these things. Most people just kind of skip all this stuff. And what they do instead is they kind of do something that they like. You know, it's kind of the do what you love and the money will follow idealism kind of thing, or do what you know and hopefully someone will come and buy it, mm-hmm. rather than doing some analysis and really understanding the market and understanding where the opportunities are, understanding where the gaps are. And then that all-important piece, which is once you identify what it is that's the opportunity, positioning yourself as unique. Will you talk a little bit about that and why that's important?
Well, yeah. First of all, I think that I want people to be passionate about their success. It's critical. If you're not passionate, you know, I always tell people, I'm going to answer your question, but I want to make sure I fill in a blank here, I always tell people when they come to me, they say, I want to build a business. I say, why? Because I want to make money. I say, but why do you want to do it? Because I want to make money. I say, you likely will fail. You have to have passion. Business is tough. You know, when you get in there, you better be passionate about what you're doing, you know. So, yeah, first and foremost, you do need to be passionate. But also, you want to be smart about it. And again, because today, the world is far more competitive. There's far more people out there that want to do likely what you want to do. And so differentiating yourself is the only way to succeed in today's world. You know, if you're an internet business, this is especially true because people from all over the world can access your local marketplace. And even if you're a local business, again, you've got different competitors. So, you know, what it is about finding, you know, what you're passionate about. If somebody says, well, God, I really am into snowboarding and I really want to start a snowboarding business, I'd say that's great. So what's going to be unique about your snowboarding business? Because I can go to, we have Dick's Sporting Goods here, or I can go to one of the other big discounters and I can buy a snowboard. So what's going to make you unique? Why am I going to go to you versus them? You have to get real clear on that. And you better have a powerful, what I call compelling differentiator. You know, you go to your place because you're going to, when you buy a board from you guys, you're going to be taught specific skills, or you're going to have somebody who is going to customize the board, or you have somebody who's really lives and breathes it. It's not just a salesperson who's selling baseball bats and snowboards, but somebody who really understands, been there, done that, that can teach you some things that really make it a great experience for you. What is it that makes you unique? It's critical.
And you're not talking about, you know, the average what makes you unique? Well, we care about our customers, or we give good customer service here. You're talking about something tangible.
Oh, absolutely. If you can't, if there's not a compelling reason for me to do business with you, I'm going to go somewhere else. The minute, and for this is for most businesses on this call, I'm sure, the minute you are competing on price in today's world, you're in deep trouble. You know, and so you cannot afford to compete on price. You have to be able to demonstrate you have better quality. You have to demonstrate that when somebody learns your specific sales or marketing techniques, that they're going to get clear, measurable differences in performance. I need to know that when I put your swimming pool in my yard, it's going to have, it's a unique design, one of a kind. It's got special water features. It's made in such a way it's going to last for a lifetime. It's going to reduce the cost of my utility bill by 23%. These are the things that you have to be able to demonstrate to your customer in order to win them.
Right. And again, concrete, measurable, not ambiguous in any way, and not based on I like you guys kind of thing.
Although that's nice, yeah.
It is. Okay, so so that's, you know, I would agree that that's probably one of the most critical pieces of kind of your planning and strategy is to plan by actually doing some analysis. You're not just making up a business plan, but you're going out and figuring out what the market needs and then figuring out how to have that compelling differentiator, like you said. Now, what about optimizing for profit? And I know that this is an area where you have a lot of passion and it's something that you're very, very good at. And you're one of the few people that says there's as much money in optimizing as there is in growing. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that, you know, because it is really the key. Right now, you know, we're looking at, you know, you're hearing in the media about a recession and certainly the market's changed. And certainly if you're in the housing industry, the mortgage industry, you're facing it already. And, you know, what ends up happening is companies get so focused on growing that they don't optimize their profitability. And I actually just created a newsletter that goes out to my my list, and I called it Conversion is King. And I'm going to give you an example of what optimization is all about. So suppose you have a company and they're generating leads, let's say a million leads a year to make the math easy. I don't care whether it's coming from newspaper or the internet or direct mail. It doesn't really matter. And you say, well, suppose that company had a baseline conversion rate, a response rate of 2%, and they increased it to 3%. And suppose that that same company, once somebody actually responded, set an appointment. Let's say that they're a business that does home services, and 24% of the people set up appointments that call in. The guy goes, "Hey, I'm doing pretty good." I said, "Great." He said, "Let's go spend more money in advertising." He said, "Not just wait a minute. Just stay with me here. Let's suppose that they increase that methodically from 24% to 28%. Not a huge difference. And let's say that out of that they quote 34%." And now they can quote 38%. And let's say out of the people that they quote, 44% of them say, yes, we're going to have you do our services at our home. And they increase that to 48. All these little small changes. The difference is same exact dollar spent on advertising, same exact effort in the entire process. You're just doing everything a little better. Does that make sense?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And let's just say, the example I used here was that the per unit cost was $500. The difference in annual revenue of that, when you do the math, is $500,000 versus $1,072,000.
Mm.
So that's a way a company can double their business. So I always say, when somebody says to me, well, I want to spend more money, I need to go get more clients or more patients, I say, yes, but you got to optimize first. Heck, that'll fund all of the marketing dollars you need in order to grow your business. But if you're spending money on trying to grow your business and you're not optimizing it, number one, you're wasting money you're never going to get back. And number two, those are the people who they go, God, I keep growing. I was a million last year. Now I'm doing a million and a half, doing 2 million. I just don't seem to be making any more money. So being able to optimize your profitability is really crucial. And here's the cool thing about it, Evan, is that it's easy. It doesn't cost anything. It's little time, money, effort, or risk. You know, if I am already selling to customers and now I'm going to upsell them at the point of purchase, or I'm going to upsell them more effectively at the point of purchase. So I'm a home-based business again, and I'm doing landscaping, and I now get them to to add a flower bed or something, that's easy. I have a relationship with a customer. I already am there. I'm good at what I do already. And it's just adding more on that I'm already doing. So whether or not somebody's looking to increase conversion rate, they're looking to add on sales to customers, of getting them to buy other things that they produce or that they sell, or getting them to buy more frequently. All of these are really simple systems and tactics that companies should be doing before they grow. I'm going to give you another great example of a guy came to me, and I'll keep the company nameless. He's a client of mine, and he does $2.5 million in the healthcare field. And he came to me and he said, "Scott, I want to have you be my coach, because I want to have you take my company statewide, and then I want to stamp these clinics out nationwide." And I said, "Great." And he goes, "And, you know, we need to go get funding, and I need you help with all that." And I said, "Well, what are you doing to optimize your business?" And he said, "Well, you know, we're doing pretty good." So I'll spare you all the details, but the bottom line is we dug in and started looking at what he's doing. Patients come in, they spend about $4,700 on the services he provides, and they're done. And so I said to him, I said, "Well, let me ask you a question. At the end of this 12-week cycle, what do you then do in order to be able to profit off those customers, or those, in this case, patients, on an ongoing basis?" He paused and didn't say anything. And I said, "Well, you know, do you have an ongoing program?" He said, "No." And I said, "Well, great. Let me ask you a question. How many of those patients are going to have that pain again in 3 months or 6 months or 12 months?" And he said, "Probably the vast majority." And I said, "Great. We're going to create a program. We're going to call it Pain Free for Life. And as long as you can ethically tell me that if somebody comes in once a month, spends 18 minutes in your clinic, that it's going to help them to remain pain-free for life, I'm going to make you $200,000 a year right now." And that's what we did. We created a simple system, put it into place, and it's generating around $18,000 a month. And so it's looking for those increases. And I will tell you that that's a significant increase in this person's take-home pay.
Yeah.
So those are the kind of things that sit in every business, because we've somehow been conditioned, marketed to, that, you know, it's all about the holy grail, double, triple, quadruple sales with this new sales system, this new advertising system, going on the internet, you know. And the bottom line is that although some of those things can work, they're risky, and they require a lot of effort. And the first place companies should look is right within their own doors.
Okay, so then another thing that you mentioned that I've never really heard other business experts mention is reducing risk, but doing it in the context of your business, right? Normally, we think in terms of reducing risk, doing it in the from the customer's perspective, making it easier for them to do business with us because they don't have a lot of risk. So what do you mean by reducing risk?
Well, before anybody puts anything into place, there's a process they should go through to reduce the risks. And what I mean by that is there's a methodical step-by-step process that'll help you identify if something is going to work. Doesn't guarantee it. But if I have an idea that I think is going to be really cool for my customers, and I say, "This is really great, and I can go and buy this new system, or I can sign up for this new advertising campaign, or new marketing campaign, or this new machine that's going to make me more efficient." There's a whole bunch of things I can do to reduce risk. The first is I can get on the phone and call 10 customers and talk to them about this new service. And if I can't get a significant number of those 10 to say yes, they would buy that, then I have a bad idea, because I'm not going to be able to communicate that in an email. I'm not going to be able to communicate that effectively in direct mail if I can't do it in person on the phone with my customers. So the first thing to do is, there's a lot of things that sound great. Now I want to call my customers or my prospects and feel them out. The next thing I will do is, now they haven't ponied up any dollars yet, so it's easy to say yes. So the next thing I'll do is we will now market in small increments. Now, this is important because although it sounds logical, there's a proper execution to it. So, you know, I don't want somebody to go out and get, you know, 2,500 names and 2,500 postcards and say, 1, 2, 3, now we're going to go and try this. I want them to do it in small segments. So they're spending a small amount of money to validate it. Now, it may not be as pretty. It may not, you know, it may not be as professional, but they can test it with just a basic direct mail campaign to see if they get a response. And again, if they don't, if the response is dismal, does it mean that if I doll it up and really make it look great and professional, I won't get a response? No, but it means it's risky to do that. You know, if I get a great response because I've done it simply and in a small group, does it guarantee that as I roll it out, the dynamics won't change? No. But does it reduce the risk significantly? Yes. You know, pay-per-click is just the most awesome testing tool on the planet, in my opinion, because I can now say I've got an idea for a product. I can go and put $500 in the till for Google AdWords. We can run the ad. We can see the response rates. We can determine, by the way, scientifically what my cost per acquisition is before I roll it out. So there's a lot of little things like that you can do to reduce, you know, your risk. So I always tell people, just do it on the back of an ad. Remember I gave the example of the doctor that was going to put that add-on service in at his clinic. So here's what I said to him, and this is interesting. This applies to everybody out there, I think, when it comes to implementation, is I could have said, okay, what I want you to do is I want you to, you know, create this system, create the price sheet, create a nice little glossy flyer on this. Let's create the script. Let's create the, you know, the whole pricing sheets and a whole nine yards. Let's do that whole thing, and then we're going to test it. I didn't do that. What I did is I said, let me ask you, I said, here's what I want you to do this week. I want you to ask 4 patients if they would do this and spend $300. Get their commitment. Go ahead and get their commitment. We'll figure out how we'll actually do it later. Just ask 4 patients. He comes back. I said, 1 out of 4 say yes, you make $60,000 a year in profit if we can continue. He comes back and he said, 3 out of 4 said yes. I said, cool. Now we got a pretty good feeling it's going to work. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, that's fantastic. And you're reducing risk not by... again, it's not a traditional way of reducing, it's not a traditional thought process. What you're doing is, it's like you're ensuring success or, you know, raising the probability of success, which has the side effect of reducing the risk of failure.
Yeah, it's right. And also understand we're entrepreneurs. What does that mean? That means we have 50 ideas a week that we think are good, you know, and, you know, so we want to chase lots of things. And you know what? Some of them are great ideas and some of them are pretty poor ideas. And the goal is to not pay dearly for the poor ideas. And it's not just money. You don't want to burn your intellectual capital, your people capital, and your resources going after something that isn't going to pay off. And, you know, I see this all too often. And people come back and say, well, you know, I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have hired that new position because I say, oh, you haven't even validated that. You've got a product that's going to sell and you're already hiring salespeople and support staff and getting a call center, which, by the way, is a true story of a client who spent $80,000 trying to get a call center up only to find out that nobody wanted the product they're trying to sell.
That is a bummer, my friend.
And unfortunately, all too common. And, you know, with a recession or the challenging market that comes up. And by the way, a lot of people, whether it's recession or it's boom time, every industry has their ups and downs. And I have a strong belief that the difference between making money and creating wealth comes down to the little things. It's about optimizing the business. It's about making sure that you are running the business as profitably as possible. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, when I talked about before about acquiring companies, and when we were acquiring companies, we were paying anywhere between 5 and 7 times earnings. So if some company was weren't earning, you know, $1 million, we were going to try and buy them for $5 million. We'd go as high as $7 million, depending on the dynamics. So that means that, you know, every $1,000 extra that you're earning as a company because you're sweating the small things, you're making sure that you're optimizing, may seem boring to somebody. Somebody's going to pay you $7,000 more for your business when it comes time to sell. And even if you don't sell, if you systemize it, I'll use that word over and over and over again and explain what it means in a few minutes. If you systematize it, that means, like, let's go back to the doctor again. When he puts that system in place, which we've now created a detailed system, every year he's in practice, he's going to apply that system. He's going to tweak it. He's going to modify it. And the product or the service that he's promoting may change. But it's 200,000 this year. It's 400,000. It's 600,000. 5 years, it's $1 million. And that's what's important about sweating the details.
Mm. All right. So let's say I've got a small, fast-growing business right now, or a business I'd like to have grow fast. And I say, okay, I want to implement this process. And, you know, I want to make my plan and my strategy. I want to optimize my profit. I want to reduce my risk. What's step one that I should do to create my plan and my strategy?
Okay, the first thing that you ought to do is you ought to take what is called a success inventory. And what that means is that you want to look around and find out what you're doing well. Every business does something well. And think of this exercise as something that has a conversion or optimization element to it. So, for example, I have a sales process. And again, I don't care whether you're a retail business and you've got Mary Sue, who's a high school graduate, who's working there, you know, in the hours you're not there. There's a process of a person comes in, I greet them, they look at the product, I have a specific script for them. There's a process you go through. If I am selling anything, there's a process I go through for sales. And so what you want to do is say, you know what, we do that really well. We place ads and we get a 4% conversion rate. We're doing pretty well. You know, you want to identify things that you're doing well already. And here's why, because it's the easiest and funnest to do. Why? Because it works. So what you want to do is you want to identify, that's literally making a list. Well, let's see, we treat patients, you know, real effectively, and we average 40 treatments per patient. And we have a 4% response rate on our killer ad we place. And we're averaging $1,653 per client. You make a list of the things you think you do well. And then what you do is you then write out what the success formula is for each one of these. This is so easy to do because you already do it. You want to capture it. You want to say, okay, well, first of all, the person comes in and we, you know, we meet with them, and then we go through this script, and then we present our offer. And then if they, you know, here's our closes. And if they don't close, we have this simple follow-up system to try to make sure we drive them in to get them to finally buy our product or service. Once you make that list, that's what I call, that is the way it is now. You go, cool, I'm doing pretty good. This is pretty successful. Then what you want to do is you want to look to one up these. So literally one up each element. Not all of them. Not all of them at once. You got too many things going on. You're taking care of customers. You're taking care of employees. You're dealing with financial issues. So you go back and say, what if I were to improve this one element? What if I were to increase the number of people that show up for an appointment once I set it? What if I had a follow-up process where rather than only 60 or 70% of the people actually being there when I got to the home, or 60 or 70% of the people being there when I called them, I could increase that to 90%. What could I do? And what will happen when you do this is logically, really rapidly, the logical ones will pop up to the surface. So the first thing you do is optimize what's already working. And then the second step that you would go through is you'd begin to look and say, you know what, I'm going to ask myself a couple key questions. Are my customers, my patients, or my clients, are they buying all of what I sell from me? You see the power of that question. If I am selling supplements, maybe they buy from my health food store. Maybe they also go to the grocery store where they've got a health food section there. If they are coming to me for certain types of alternative care, are they coming to me for other types of alternative care that I also offer? So the first thing you want to do is ask yourself, are they buying all of what they're buying from me? If not, how can I improve upon that? And that's where things like upsell and cross-sell come into place. So somebody comes and they are purchasing vitamins from you. I want to get them to buy a bigger bottle of vitamins. I want them to buy the other vitamin or the supplement that helps that particular vitamin absorb at an even greater level. Because they're right there. They're in front of you. You want to optimize that transactional value ethically. I always use ethically because I want to make sure people are selling people things that they need. You know, and then you want to be able to increase frequency. So, you know, I want to be able to make sure I can get people back to my store. I want to get people back to my website on an ongoing basis more frequently, so they're not buying from somebody else. You know, I think I gave an example of when we were talking one time about a dentist, and I always laugh about a dentist because, matter of fact, I had somebody talking to me about it today, and they go, well, you know, the dentist seemed to do a pretty good job following up and getting you back in there. And I said, yeah, but understand that that is not, for most dentists, a technique for success. It's a technique for for survival. Right? They want you to come back in so they can pluck at your gums and let them bleed and tell you that you're not cleaning your teeth right and have the suction tube and you're like, ugh. So, you know, dentists do a real good job with this, but, you know, other businesses, you know, they don't. They don't follow up with their customers. They don't make sure that they're conditioning their customers to literally buy from them over and over and over again as long as there's a need. So these are the types of things that you do. You want to make sure that you look at other areas. Are they buying a broad line of what I'm offering? You know, it's interesting is that the guy who did our landscaping here at my home never once offered to do my landscape maintenance, even though he does landscape maintenance. Does that make sense?
He was waiting for you to say, you want some more money?
Or just so focused in on thinking, well, I should know. It says on the side of his truck, landscape and landscape maintenance. So, you know, I spend, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars on my yard, and I spend $1,000 or so a month on my maintenance. And I'll do that for year after year after year. And he's missing out on it.
So, you know, because I can tell you're so passionate about optimizing, it sounded like even in the planning and the strategy, you're thinking optimization right from the beginning. What about, you know, if I've got my small growing business, what are the first places I should look to optimize? Where is the hidden money waiting to be found?
Well, it does depend on businesses. And so typically the hidden money is in not maximizing the dollars that you're getting from your existing clients. And again, it's because usually you don't understand your clients or you don't understand your customers. And so you want to be able to do that. So give an example is, even if I were to take a dry cleaner, you say, well, Scott, okay, a dry cleaner, I'm going to accumulate my clothes and I'm going to bring them in my dry cleaning. I'd say, okay, that's probably true. But number one, I want to make sure that they're always bringing them into me because it's a convenience item. You know, sometimes my wife will drop them off at one location if she's going to pick up the kids for school. And if she's going to the grocery store, she's dropping them off at another location. So you really want to start to make sure that you're building relationships with those customers so that they want to come in to you every time. The second thing with a dry cleaner is you have a dry cleaner that also does dry cleaning of drapes, leather goods, a lot of other unusual items that people don't often think of. And you have dry cleaners that do everything from mending to tailoring. So I'll give you a great example. I had a guy, I did this program on a radio called the $25,000 Profit Challenge. And my thing was, you know, anybody call me up that's $300,000 business or more, I'll find them $25,000. So the radio host said, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to pick six businesses and send them your way, which they did. And I fudged a little because there was about 10 businesses. I got to pick the six of the 10 that I thought would work well. And this one guy, we kept trying to set an appointment with him, and he was dry cleaning on four or five dry cleaning businesses. And so I get on the phone with this guy, and he's one of those guys that already knows everything. You know, he's the chairman of the committee of Dry Cleaners Association of whatever the state he was in. And he said, you know, I just wanted to talk to you so I could show you that, you know, I know the stuff already. And I said, that's cool. Let's just go ahead and let me ask you a couple questions. So he goes on and talking about referrals. He goes, oh, yeah, man, I get the most incredible referral thing. And we do donuts when people come in and coffee, and people love us. And I said, what else do you do? And he goes, well, we do draperies. And we do these, you know, we go in and we take the draperies down, and it's $1,000 a household. He goes, and we make great money at it. I go pick them up, I deliver them. I said, wow, that's cool. And he says, yeah, we got delivery trucks. I said, wow, that's really great. So let me ask you a question. I said, how well are you doing at making sure your customers are using all your services? He goes, well, I'm going to do them pretty good. I said, well, you just told me you have all of these dry cleaning customers where you go out and do their drapes and you hand deliver them and all that good stuff. He said, yep, I do it myself. I said, let me ask you a question. What percentage of those are dry cleaning customers? Absolute dead silence. Absolute dead silence. So I said, he said, well, I don't really know. He said, but you know, I don't, and now as you mentioned, it's probably not as high as it should be. Well, I'll fast forward the story because he comes back the next day, gets back on the phone with me and says it's 5 or 10%. I proceed to do my math like I like to do and say, wow, you're picking up, you're delivering, they're loyal to you, but you forgot to tell them. He goes, got me. I said, let me tell you how much I got you. And we went through the math, and I don't know the exact number, but I think it was, as I do my impact over 5 years, it was over $1 million. I said, if only 3 out of 10 of those guys start using you for dry cleaning, which they will because they love you, it was a big number, $300,000 or $400,000. So I get back on live radio interviewing this guy with the host, and he comes back and says it wasn't 3 out of 10, it was 7 or 8 out of 10 that said yes. So again, I'm trying to point out that don't get cocky. Take a look at your business and say, how can we get more out of our customers that we already have? Don't assume that they know all of the things that you gave them in your brochure when you first went there. You know, and I could just go on and on. I like to use a lot of household examples. And the reason is not because I work with a lot of household clients, it's just we can all relate to them. You know, but it's if you've got somebody who is a house cleaning service, a lot of the house cleaning services also do all kinds of other services around the home, including cleaning windows. But they don't ever tell you that or remind you about that because they gave you a brochure the first time that they went to work for you, and you're supposed to know that. So you want to look in your existing customer base. And the other thing is, talk to them. You know, talk to your customers. Understand more about them. You know, it's interesting. Whenever I give clients this assignment, I always feel this cringe. Well, I don't know. It's kind of uncomfortable. You need to talk to them and communicate with them and understand what it is that they need. Because, see, the key to this working, Evan, is not, it's not so much, I can give lots of ideas. And I'm going to guess that, you know, anybody listening to this interview is into training, you know, training like you do and training like, you know, a lot of the other folks you and I both know. So they're not short of ideas. You know, I'm giving ideas here because they're things that are practical and work, and I like to focus on things that are proven and time tested. But it's not as much about the ideas as it is about the consciousness, the mindset, and the execution. If you are looking within your business and saying, how can I sell more to my existing customers? How can I improve the things we're already doing well just a little bit? Because I just learned from this guy named Scott Hallman that if I take and extrapolate that out over 3 or 4 or 5 years, and I do this in 2 or 3 areas of my company, it can really become a big number. So that's the kind of things that are really, you know, really important. You know, you take things like referral systems. And I always tell people when they come to me about referral systems, this is another great place to focus in your business. You know, if you're good at what you do and people love you and you're passionate about it, you should get a lot of referral business. You know, and so many people got excited about this because the gurus out there would say, all you have to do is just ask and you'll double your business. Well, you know what? That's not true. So I'm going to drill down on execution here again. I teach something called 16 Reasons Referral Systems Fail, and I'll probably increase it as I learn more of them. But you,
it's going up every day.
It keeps going up, and here's why, because I see what people do wrong. So I said, first of all, is most companies have what's called a passive referral system. What's that mean? It means I'm really good at what I do, so when I come across somebody that that talks to me about you, I'm going to tell them. I said, okay, that's interesting. So if we're in conversation and somebody asks about a service, I say, God, you got to go to Evan Pagan's event. That thing is incredible. You know, you absolutely get involved in his altitude. It's such an amazing event, and you're going to learn every aspect of your business. That's very different than you activating me. Now, in the internet world, we try to do that with affiliates and getting people to send out to their list. But most businesses, they don't activate them. They're just passive. And so once I actually am getting people to reach into their sphere of influence, not just telling my neighbor who asked me about who's a good dentist or who's a good lawn cleaning service or who's a good window washing service to use home-based businesses again, but actually getting my client or my customer to send a letter out to the neighborhood to let them know about the fact that if they've got the same issue and the same challenge with trying to find reliable people, we found somebody really great. It's a 1 or 2 or 3 or 400% impact. Now, along the execution, I'll add one other element to this, because I really want to try in this interview to be able to give people, you know, not just ideas, but some real meat that they can apply. And it's, you know, the 16 reasons referral systems fail, I don't have time to do it all here because it's an hour and a half long program, is, you know, looking at things like, okay, you get a referral. What typically happens? You say, you know, hey, do you know anybody that, you know, might be interested in our product? And somebody says, oh, you know what? I got this guy, Bill, and Bill over at such and such company, he might be interested. And you say, great. And he said, you say, can, well, what's his contact information? And the guy says, you know, I don't have my Outlook in front or with me, or I don't have my BlackBerry with me. I'll get it to you. Boom, dies. There's no follow-up. The well-meaning guy that's referring forgets to call you. You don't ever get it. You know, it's simple, simple things like that. Or then when I follow up, say, you know what, okay, it gives me the contact information. The very next thing you need to do, if you give me the contact information and I now call that person you referred me to, we'll call Tom, and Tom doesn't know me from Adam, and I say, well, Bill said to give you a call. You feel how that can be a little cold. It's warmer than calling him out of the blue, but it's still a little cold. So what we want to do is we want to elevate that. What's that mean? Well, it means I go out to Bill and I say, Bill, this is really great. I appreciate the referral. Will you do me a favor? Will you call Tom for me and just tell him a little bit about what you think about me in your own words? So that way he sort of knows when I call a little bit about me. And do you see how different that experience is?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, now, I want to tie this in with what we were talking about before, because this goes back to optimization. So remember I said, you know, if you might have a procedure that says, we get referrals. And I go, God, that's really great. And you lay out your steps of the referrals. All I'm doing now is drilling down on each one of those steps and saying, do you see that if you just make that one change, the number of people that are referred to you that actually become a customer or client can go up two or three times? Even if it's just 5%, if you stack that on top of two or three more steps, it becomes interesting. So I really want to emphasize that it is about breaking the process apart and building upon it.
That's great. Now, next. And you know, I know you could go on, and we could probably talk for 5 days about just optimization ideas. And I'm not exaggerating; you probably have 5 days worth easily. What's a practical step someone could take to, in your term, reduce risk? How would someone, you know, I own a business; it's growing right now. Where do I go first to really look for opportunity to reduce risk?
Well, you know, the first thing that comes to my mind is marketing and advertising. And I'm going to give you a different spin on what I said before. Is,
you know what? It's already different, because anytime you're reducing risk in marketing, you're talking my language.
All right. So I'll give you a great example. But first, let me explain the concept. I have worked with hundreds and hundreds of clients one-on-one. I've worked with thousands and thousands of companies. And whenever I ask the following question, nobody seems to know the answer. And I say, "What's your acquisition cost per customer?" Silence. So let me give you an example. As I've got a client that I worked with, they're a bankruptcy firm, and they're in Texas, and they're rather prominent in the multiple locations. And what happened in bankruptcy, I don't know if you remember, but the laws changed, and it made it much more difficult to file bankruptcy. And this particular firm, and every other firm in America for a while, the number of clients that they got dropped almost 50%. So imagine you have your infrastructure in place to support all these people, and boom, your business drops in half, literally. So now focusing on risk reduction and optimization become important. Sorry to use the O word, but in the risk reduction become important. So I said, well, let me ask you a question. You're spending this much money a month on your marketing and advertising. Now we need to spend it really wisely. So let me ask you a question. What is your cost per acquisition of the different channels? They were doing TV. They were doing radio. They were doing ads in like the Penny Saver. They were spending money on the internet. And I said, we need to know. It's amazing. As we did this, they ranged from $146 to $1,100. And I'm guessing what the number is, $1,100 and some dollars. The difference... Now, how can I reduce risk? I'm going to go with more known quantity. I'm going to expand upon that greater. I'll give you another example of a consumer business that I just got off the phone with 2 weeks ago, who was advertising in the local paper, and they were advertising in Valpak. And they served 15 or 20 communities in a 200-mile radius. And I said to them, what's your cost per acquisition? Didn't know. It was, and again, the numbers are not exact. I want to make sure I'm trying to be as accurate as possible. It was the difference between $300 and about $1,100 or $1,200 or $1,300. It was big. So I said, gosh, you know what you need to do is don't do Valpak anymore. Sorry, Valpak, but don't do Valpak anymore. But why don't you take the exact same success formula that's working in your local newspaper and let's take that same money and let's put it into these other smaller newspapers that are going to be way less expensive. Now, if we want to reduce risk, first of all, you understand that that's a calculated risk. In other words, it's working in the newspaper. So for me to spend all that money at once in those multiple newspapers is at least a calculated risk. Very different than saying, now I'm going to go do an advertisement on the internet. Now I'm going to do radio. Those are big risk. So
yeah, of course.
What happens is, though, you can go beyond calculated by simply doing a test. So the first step that I advise them to do is just take one of those local communities, plop it in there, and let's see what it looks like. So, you know, reducing risk it's very difficult to reduce risk if you don't go back to having measurements and metrics so that you know what your baselines are. Otherwise, how do you know what your risk is?
You know, that's probably a great segue into this idea of systemizing and creating processes and, you know, really doing it, not just talking about it and saying, I think I'm going to put some systems in my business, but actually executing it. Can you talk a little bit to, you know, just the idea here of what does it mean to put a process or a system in your business?
Yeah, this is a great question because, again, I said earlier, it's the boring way to riches. Nobody wants to do it. It's not exciting. Or an entrepreneur, show me something new. What it means to systemize is to first of all, you have to determine what you think the likely impact of what you're going to put into place is. Let me tell you why this is important. If I can identify, if I can identify that something I'm going to put into place is going to make $100,000 a year profit impact if I do it properly, and somebody's right now making $200,000 or $300,000, that's a significant number. So the minute that I do this, this is the most important step, and people don't talk about this, is I don't care whether it takes you a week or 3 months to put that in place. I don't care. What I care is that you stay focused and passionate about it until you get it done, because it's going to increase your income, in this case, a third or a half, if you pull it off. If you cannot make that resolve, then what will happen is the busyness of our days and challenges will catch up to us and you'll never get it done. So that's the first step. Once you're impassioned about it, go, wow, it's $100,000, it's $500,000 after 5 years, makes my business worth $500,000 or $600,000 more, then you can begin the process. Now, I don't have time to go into how you would systematize, but I can give you the principles. And the first principle is you have got to document it. And this is probably the greatest resistance I get from entrepreneurs is they don't want to document, they don't want to write about it. Mary knows how to do it. I said, you have to, it's true.
Yeah.
And I go, you have to document it. And the reason you have to document it is once it's in writing, it triggers, and I don't know the science behind it, but it triggers a whole different development process in our brains. Where I'm going, well, no, why do we do it that way? Or why should we do it that way? Or will that really work? It starts dialogue. People can look at it along the same vein and be able to give input. You have something to go back and train people with. So the first step is simply to take that thing you just got excited about and say, okay, I'm going to now improve our internet conversion rate. We've identified the fact that once somebody lands on our site, if we can increase the number that actually click and put something in the checkout box by 25% in absolute terms, it'll produce $100,000 profit. I say, great. Now, what that means is it's rather methodical, right? I now have to look at my headlines and see whether or not my headlines are strong. I have to look at where I place stuff on the homepage, or like, you know, you did a really cool thing at Altitude where you talked about, colors and where pictures were located, all of those things, right? So all of that whole project takes time. You have to do it. You have to test it. You have to come back and move things around, change offers. But again, as long as you stay on the resolve of, gosh, you know what? I know if I do this, I can make that small increase, and that increase is $100,000, then that process becomes something you'll stay with. So you document it. And then once you've documented it, and you have the measurements in place. In other words, if I were to stay with the internet, I now know what percentage of people that come to my site are actually plopping something in the checkout cart, because I won't go from the checkout cart to actually purchasing yet, because that might be another project. Once I know that, I can now trend it. And this is really important. You need to trend your success of or your metric. So if I now know it's 2.2% to start with and I want to increase it to 2.8%, I now need to know what was it this week, the following week. And I go, okay, now I'm going to start making changes, not multiple ones at once. I'm going to start making one change at a time. And the internet's a cool medium for that's why I use it as an example. If you have enough volume, I can now tweak that until I get it into a range. Once I get it into what I call a success range, we're not really making any more improvement, but we're able to keep it between 2.6 and 3.0. I now know that I've got something successful. So, you know, in order to be able to do that, I got to go, I document it. I then look and say, well, you know what? This is probably the most likely process that's causing us a problem. Let's work on this one first, the headline. Or once somebody lands on the page, before I'm even trying to sell them something, I've already shown them the price. Maybe that's not a good idea. And you methodically work at it, all in writing, by the way. You're writing this down. So you end up with what I call a success formula. And if you take any element to your business and apply that what I just said and do it, apply it poorly, it will transform your business. If you want to then learn, you know, how do I write a procedure and how do I, you know, code a procedure and make sure that I build a procedure manual so that, you know, everybody has access to it. There's a gazillion, you know, books on that actual function.
Yeah, it's interesting because one of the metaphors that I use in business is combining leverage points, right? Where you plug several things that get high leverage together. And then at the end, you get something that's astounding. It's like it doesn't even seem like it's possible. It's like, you know, compounding interest, you know, over 100 years or something like that. And, you know, I know you know exactly what I'm talking about here. But there's really nowhere else you can do this kind of thing. There's nowhere else you can get this kind of leverage consistently. You can't go to Vegas and do it, you know, unless you're the number one poker player, you know, in the room. You can't do it. You know, with the stock market, you can't do it in most places, you know, starting from scratch. But in business, you can. If you just learn what all these leverage points are and then combine them with each other, you can grow a very profitable business very quickly while most other people are failing because they're not even thinking about these things.
Yeah, it's a cool thing, isn't it?
It is.
And without risk, with little minimized risk.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Now, you know, another area that I know that you specialize in is conversion, and it's, you know, my favorite area as well in business because there's so much leverage there. Can you talk a little bit about conversion, what it is, how you think about it, and some of the approaches that you use to get higher conversion?
Yeah, it's great. Again, it's about documenting the steps. I teach something I call conversion driver technology. It's not a very good name, but I named it a long time ago. But if you think about steps along the way, steps in the buying process, they're levers. They're literally levers. So I'll go back to the consumer law practice that I had talked to you about, and they placed ads, and they had 28.3, I remember these numbers pretty well, 28.3% of the people that they called into this 5-minute pre-recorded call, you know, this is the law firm of so-and-so. And so 28.3% of those people then called the office. And then of those people that called the office, they then had a certain conversion rate. And the people called after hours, they had a different conversion rate because they had to now call them back. So you had these levers. So think about it this way. You sort of say, yeah, start off with they called the pre-recorded line. Ah, there's an opportunity, if I haven't revisited it, to see whether we can change that recording and increase it from a boring 28.3% to 30%. That's it. I go, okay, let's look at leverage number two. Lever number two says, okay, well, how many of those people that called in actually set up an appointment to come see an attorney? Now, I just want to before I go on with the rest of these steps, because I think it's really going to be a great exercise for everybody, it was astounding to find out that if they talk to the people live, they set up 86% of them as appointments. If they had to call them back and got a hold of them within 15 minutes, it was in the 60s. And if it was more than an hour, it dropped below 50%. And if it was the next day, it dropped below 25%. Now, This is really critical because it's about conversion. I could not have done that without identifying that as a lever. I could not have done that without tracking the conversion rates based on those times. So you see there's a little bit of analysis I had to go on there?
Yeah, of course.
Once I do that, now I go, whoa, how can we possibly answer more of these live? How can we make sure we get back to people within 5 minutes? Why? Because if I play this whole lever out, you're going to see it's a difference between, billing $200,000 a month and $300,000 a month. So then the next step along the way, and I'll just go through a few more so you get the idea. The next step along the way is what's called show rate, right? They set up an appointment. Did they show up? Well, there was a certain percentage there, say 80%. What can we do to get more to show? Why? Because if more show and go through the rest of my funnel, think of conversion like a funnel. If they go through the rest of my funnel, I have a guaranteed success rate from there on out, statistically, for every other person I can get in top of that funnel and push all the way through the funnel. So then I said, okay, well, then what happens is they show up for the appointment and now I have to retain them. And of those that don't retain, I now have to have a follow-up system. And by the way, even in his practice, there was 13 drivers. In his practice, once he retained them, then they had to get them back in to pay the deposit. And then once they got them to pay the deposit and filed, you go, okay, cool, I'm done. And that was their attitude. They were done. I said, gosh, I don't think you're done. I don't think we're done with this conversion. I think a conversion is when a dollar drops into my bank. So we went one step further and said, what we found was that these people that retained, if we got them on auto deduction from their payroll, we would get 300, I'm making this number up, I can't remember, it's a big number, it's like 300% more of them would stay compliant on their payment plan through bankruptcy. It's a big, big number. So the key here is that conversion is broken up into steps. It's what it's all about. You have to identify the levers, the little changes you can make. If I am a salesperson and I want to increase my conversion rate on a sales call, you can break this down into steps, and I'm going to show you how you break it down into micro steps. So I could break it down a step saying, when I go on an appointment, I close 30% of the people that I speak with. I go, that's pretty cool. And if I follow up, I get another 5%. If I follow up 6 times, I get another 8%. That's good. You're really doing well. So I go, but suppose during the sales call, sales process, I start to look at how can I get that 30% higher? Should I spend more time on building rapport? Should I get more yeses before I give the proposal? Should I, and so on and so forth. You start breaking it down. See, because again, it's if I can get that 30 to 35% and I can get that follow-up from 8% to 9%, I transform business. And that's why I call conversion. I always tell my clients and people that I talk to, conversion's king. Right now, and I'm going to, a little side note here, is in business right now, if you're on the internet, and Evan, you're far more of an expert in this area than I am. But the advice I say is, when it comes to pay-per-click search engine optimization, and it comes to most products, generally consumers are going to, or dating, or whatever the site is, most consumers are going to drill down 1, 2, 3, maybe they'll check out 3 or 4 companies. If I'm looking for a mortgage or I'm looking for a product. Does that make sense?
Yeah, okay. Sure.
If that's the case, I better be one of those 1, 2, 3, or 4. Now, in order to be one of those 1, 2, 3, or 4, and I'll just stay in the pay-per-click world right now, it's all you're paying. I mean, we pay for I have a client who's for the term lemon law in their particular state, lemon law attorney is $47 a click. Now, you better be a master at converting or you can't play the game.
$47 a click is, man, they're probably bummed out about any click fraud, huh?
Well, yeah, it is. It certainly is a challenge, and and so you really have to decide what place you want to be in, and those are other issues about what's our conversion rate if we're in one position, number two position, number three position, or blended. We like 1.6 is where it seems to work best for us. But my point is, without getting into a pay-per-click discussion, is that's what's going to happen. Every industry ends up, if you watch dominant industries, it always seems to end up where there's two or three dominant players. Google and Yahoo. AOL was a dominant player once upon a time. They've really fallen off the map, and there was all those other guys out there that don't seem to be as prevalent anymore. And you see it in consumer products, you see it in services. It tends to come down to two or three or four players. And so if that's the case over time, conversion is king. That's the key. It drives down my cost. It makes me more effective. And if I'm more systematic than my competitor, I'm going to beat them every time, and especially over time, and especially as we go into a recession. Every single entrepreneur can do this, and they can do it quickly, and it doesn't cost them any money. As we talk about optimization too, and I know that, again, this impacts every business that's out there. And it's something I'm passionate about. Let me give you even some examples of, the companies that I've built in the past. So, one of the ones that we were effective at was when I was selling, we were system integrators in the company that we were taking public in 2000. And so what would happen would be you'd get into those businesses. And let me tell you what most guys did. Most guys would bid, and they'd get a quote, and it'd be 100,000, 200,000, whatever the number is, and they're going to go in and do the system integration, install the software, bolt it all together, and they're done. And I said, boy, are they leaving a lot of money on the table. So we did two things in that example that were really powerful. One of them is what I called, I'm going to do two of these, so to tell you these examples. So one is called ethical scope creep. And for anybody that does business on either time and materials or where you can charge more money if you stay longer, longer engagements, et cetera. Anybody out there that's a consultant can really relate to this. And what scope creep is it's when I now suggest ways for them to get even more out of what I'm doing. So here we are, and we're doing a system implementation. It's $200,000. And so what we did is, rather than just sending in our baseline project managers and our baseline team to go and do that implementation project, we always, and I spent the money to make sure I put one of my strategic guys in there for a period of time, oftentimes a week. And I might be billing him out at 250 an hour, and I'm billing out the other guys at 140 an hour, and now I'm billing him out at $140 an hour. I had a very specific purpose for it, to do two things. One was create scope creep. What's that mean? It means as they start to dive into the implementation, I go, God, seems to me that what would be great is if you could generate these kind of reports. This would be really awesome. It seems to me if we could also link this in with your other office that's in Albuquerque, you'd be able to do this. You know what? It seems to me, and now as we put this in, one of the things I noticed is, although you have some redundancy, you really, could use blah. And what happens is you easily take that $200,000 sale and increase it to 250. Easily do that. The other thing that you can do, and it's a great story, I called it mushrooming. And one of the things we did is that strategic high-end guy or gal would actually go in, and he would begin to nose around. He'd begin to ask around. He'd begin to get introduced. Why? Because these guys are doing a Siebel implementation. These guys over here are doing an internet implementation that's different. These guys over here are doing some staff augmentation thing with other technical guys and developers, and we want to mushroom that. So we had a certain telecom in Dallas that was very popular for a while, did a lot of MLM, multi-level marketing network sales. We started off in a $10,000 project, which, by the way, if we got the project, was going to be about a $200,000 project. And for 21 months straight, we billed over $1 million a month in that account. We were doing staff augmentation, which all that means is you're just putting your body shop to provide, you know, technical people. We did a Siebel implementation where we had never done one before, but we partnered up with somebody else. And our attitude was we want to take any business that comes along. So, I mean, you take something that could be $200,000 and turn it into a $20 million engagement. You know, it's the kind of things that you can do. The other thing you can do if you want to optimize is you really have to think. If let's take an internet business. Take an internet business that sells a product, and they sell that product. It's an ongoing continuity product. And they sell it for $29 or $39 a month. They can now start to think. They go, you know what? We're really good at this. Matter of fact, we upsell pretty well. I said, good for you. Good for you. You upsell from $29 a month to an annual contract. That's really great. How can you now take that? Tell me about what, if I look at the life cycle of where you want to take a customer, what is it? Well, we are going to first get them on our $29 product, and then we want to move them to try to drive them into our annual coaching, and then we want to try to drive them to a seminar, and then ultimately we want to make them part of our, whatever, premier elite coaching program. That's really cool. How well are you moving them up the ladder? And what I find, even the savvy guys, is that they're not doing a very good job with making sure they have systems in place to methodically move somebody up the ladder. Now, let's talk about systems. So somebody says, I have a system in place. I said, really, what do you do? Well, somebody comes into our program and they're on our baseline program. We got a gold program that is more expensive. And I said, okay. And so when are you going to try and move them up the ladder? And they said, well, usually, you know, we contact them a month later. I go, okay, so you contact them a month later and try to push them up to your gold program. He goes, yeah, that's what we do. And he's working pretty well. We have about 21% of the people that do this. I said, okay, what else do you do? Well, they say, well, we don't do anything. And I said, well, why don't people do it? Well, I'm not really sure. I said, bet you if you find out why people aren't upgrading and you learn a little bit more about how they're using your product and you learn a little bit more in the first 30 days or 60 days, how you can get them using your product and benefiting from your product at a greater level, you're going to see your 20% go way up. So see, it's not just systematizing. Remember I said before, I love the fact if people are systematic and they got systems in place and written procedures, that's great. But in the leveraging success technology that I teach, it only takes them to the second step. The third step is ongoing one-upping it. It's ongoing testing. When I was at your altitude event and spoke there, you did something phenomenal. I was up on stage, I was talking about conversion or something, and I talked about A-B testing. And you stopped and said, how many people out there A-B test at least once? And how many? And you got all the way down to daily. And there's a handful of guys out there that had their arms up. You said, how much you do? 20 million. How much you do? 6 million. How much you do? 3.5 million. You know, so it's systemization is taking it to the next level and making sure you're really optimizing. So when I use optimizing, it's not a static process. It's dynamic and continuous. You know?
Yeah, not a coincidence that all the people that tested the most often were all the highest performers.
Just absolutely the coolest thing. So, you know, it's one of the problems I have with my message is, you know, because you got a lot of other guys out there that have taught a lot of these principles. My job is not to teach necessarily always to be teaching new principles, but you can take old principles like Johnny Wooden, the great coach of the UCLA Bruins that won 10 out of 11 years. Nobody's ever matched it. Is, you know, it was, he'd make guys do free throws and all the fundamental dribbling thing, even though these guys were the best of the best in the country. And so optimization is just that. It's that I'm taking it to the next level constantly. And, you know, how high is high? I have another client. I'll give you another great example. And this is an example of they were a $9 million recycler in one of the major cities in the U.S. So they did scrap and, you know, aluminum, and they also did, you know, ferrous-type metals and whatnot. And when I first met him, and their business was horrible, and they weren't making any money, and I said to him, boy, we got to reinvent you. So we went back and forth, and I will tell you, for about 4 or 5 or 6 months, I struggled, and I'm not used to that. And I'm like, you know, how can I really help this guy? So finally I said, you know, the problem in your industry is that you guys are all beating the heck out of each other with prices. Let's go buy a competitor. So we went and bought a competitor with two other locations. And so now we ended up with this convenience triangle. And I had a theory. And the theory was, I'll bet that we can get 3 cents more a pound, or actually in his world, pay 3 cents less because of convenience. Now, there's a whole bunch of other benefits. So there's these synergies, and I have all these theories about this convenience. And by the way, we really didn't reduce risk here because it was really desperate. He needed to do something, so we took a risk. And so he did that. Now, I will tell you, I just got done doing an all-day planning session with him and his team, and this was 2003 when I met him. $9 million, $100,000 profit. He did $44 million this year and made $7 million profit. And he looked at me and said, the number one thing we did was that acquisition and learn to optimize profits. So let me continue with the story here. So we began to say, how high is high? This is a really great story. How high is high? So we got to 3 cents, we got to 4 cents, and we got to 5 cents. We're thinking, And I said, well, we need to do something here, going back to systems. We need to make sure that we measure your tiers of your customers. I got customers that bring in cans because it's, you know, Mary Maple from the PTA that's doing a fundraiser, and I got guys that are called jobbers, and they bring in truckloads of stuff. Let's trend and track those. They've never done it before every month, so I can see when I have the slightest drop-offs when I raise my prices. So we raised the price. I'm telling you, this is the most amazing thing for a commodity product. But in this particular city, we see for core things like copper and aluminum, anywhere between 13 and 23% difference in the prices that we're paying versus our competitors. So the message I want to get across here is you're constantly looking to improve, you know, and it's a real world. I don't care whether you're an online marketer. I don't care. I just try to give you this brick and mortar. I mean, this is as brick and mortar as you get, you know, big old cranes and the magnets picking stuff up. And, you know, it's about constantly doing that. And if you do that, you're going to be successful. I can go on and on and on. You know, I mean, I got story after story after story because I love this stuff.
Thank you very much, Scott. I mean, this was this is fantastic. I've taken a ton of notes here, and you've actually given me some ideas for some things that we need to go test here. So, I know there's a lot of value when I'm going to get off the when I'm going to walk out of the interview, and I'm going to be implementing materials myself. So, thank you very much. If someone wanted to get in touch with you or check out some of your materials or your trainings, how would they do that?
Go to my membership site where we have 45 of the specific step-by-step audio-based training and workshops of a lot of things I talked about here. Not only profit optimization, there's also several on management, and there's several on new client acquisition, even though I didn't talk about that today. So that's Small Business, all spelled out, growthclub.com. So smallbusinessgrowthclub.com, and you can go there and learn about that and access various different training materials.
Thank you very much, Scott. I really appreciate the time.
Take care.